Hello, we're Alex Rouget and Lee Chambers, and you're listening to a Bookmark podcast.
For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit the music chosen by our studio guest, but we hope you still enjoy the show.
We love being local, because we live here too.
Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark.
I'm Lee Chambers.
And I'm Alex Rouget.
And that's a good start
already. Yeah. Today on the show we have the wonderful Louise Foxcroft in the studio, and we'll also be talking to Helen Simpson, the short story writer,
and we've got an interview with feminist icon Sarah Maitland.
So Louise has written a wonderful book called Calories and Corsets, all about the history of the diet. So we're going to have an unusual quick chat about diet fads.
Diet fads we've done. Come on, be honest. 5-2, I think, is the most recent one. Everybody seems to be doing that.
Yeah.
I think it works better for men than women, actually. No. And I did find that on the 2 days that I was fasting, all I thought about was food.
Yeah.
And I felt quite weak. I was going to bed early. It was affecting my whole life. But, I've done no carbs, obviously the 1,000 calorie a day. Cabbage soup one, I think.
Oh,
there are so many. I mean, you can just sort of throw a stone and you'll hit a diet. There's just billions of them.
There are. I mean, I remember in the 80s doing Rosemary Connolly Inchloss
with
my mum. About the same time, also doing, do you remember that thing, Calinetics as well?
So I never did that. Another word.
On your bum, walking about on your bum, and then the Rosemary Connolly not eating any fat and measuring yourself constantly.
Rosemary, me and my friend did that. We were sharing a house at the time. We talked a lot about Rosemary. It was she was a personal friend, Rosemary says.
Yes.
Because she had a little thought for the day, didn't she?
Yeah. She still does, I believe. Louise, have you ever done any diets?
No. Well, I did. I did one while I was researching the book because I thought I need to know something of what I'm talking about. And I agree that you just become completely obsessed. And I'd weigh myself when I got up naked, then I'd weigh myself after I got dressed, then after breakfast, and then last thing at night, so that I had a sort of full range of numbers so I could see what was going on. And it was a vile experience. I mean, it was a really dreadful thing. I didn't enjoy it at all.
Did you lose weight?
Yeah, it was spectacular for the first 3 days. But it came with a lot of unpleasant sort of checking on everybody else. What have they got? Why can't I have some of that? Oh, no, what can I eat next? You know, when can I eat it? I did lose weight. And then after 3 days, it just sort of hit a plateau. And then I gave up.
And it plays with your mind, doesn't it? I find myself fantasising about food that really, actually, most of the time, I don't really want at all.
No, that's right, yeah. And a lot of the studies that have been... There's a very famous one in America by Ansel Keys, who was experimenting, really, on conscientious objectors during the Second World War and had them starving, really. It was on what happens to the body when when you starve it. And all of those young men became completely obsessed. And in fact, after the war, a lot of them went into catering.
It's absolutely fascinating subject. And we've got loads to talk to you about. But before we introduce you properly, we've got the first track from you, which is Howlin' Wolf. Why did you choose that?
There were quite a few to choose from, actually. It's to do with being overweight. It's to do with being fat and dieting. So that's why I chose this one. And there were quite a lot of them. I was quite surprised when I had a look around to see what there was. And I chose this one because I just like the message. More or less, he's saying, you know, I'm built for comfort. I'm not built for speed. You know, take me as I am. And I like that.
Some folk feel like that, but the way I'm built, I don't you.
Hello, you're listening to Bookmark, and in the studio today we have the writer and historian Louise Foxcroft. Louise has turned her eagle eye to many fascinating subjects to date, including the making of addiction, use and abuse of opium in the 19th century, which was her first book, Hot Flushes and Cold Science, a history of the modern menopause, which won the Longman History Today Book of the Year in 2009, and Calories and Corsets, the history of dieting over 2,000 years. She's also written a historical biography and a book on sexuality. So we're going to try and get through all of those if we can. But sticking with calories and corsets, Louise, which we were just talking about, I wondered when you came to sort of decide to write this book, was it because the diet industry made you angry?
Yeah, and it's the pernicious nature of it, and the way that they use humiliation, and the way that they use fear and anxiety, and I mean I know it sounds quite a strong thing to say, but I believe the diet industry preys on people. And not only that, what it does is sells them failure, because most of those fad diets, those quick fix novelty diets, they almost always end in failure. So you might lose 5 to 10% of your body weight to start with. You must always put it back on again, and if not more, and then you try another diet and another diet. And yo-yo dieting is known to be detrimental to the health. And a lot of the big fat diets are also detrimental to health. So, for example, I'm not sure if I can mention them, but some of the most popular ones cause serious liver damage. And there's a famous French diet chappie who's just been struck off the French medical register.
But we really have been doing the same kind of diets for thousands of years, haven't
we? That's right, yeah. It's a repetitive, cyclical business. The first best-selling diet book was published in the 16th century, and that was effectively a high-protein, low-carb diet. And you can see that coming, you know, I mean, they come up every so often. They're repackaged. You get a different celebrity promoting it. You get perhaps a different sort of diet food. You get a slightly different angle on it, you know, a bit of shiny PR. Bingo, everybody goes out and buys it. And it's the same thing wrapped up. Now, everybody knows that it's common sense. And the way to lose weight is moderation. Moderation in what you eat. Plenty of sleep, regular meals, fairly plain foods, lots of exercise. But it's just not sexy enough, and it's not quick enough, and it's not novel enough. It's the whole business is corrupt, I think, because the diet industry knows this, and yet they still go on selling it to people. And not only are they selling diets and diet foods and diet drinks and rubber belts and, you know, all these sort of ridiculous, you know, bits and bobs that you can buy, they sell you diet drugs as well.
That's right. And I mean, you write about that in the book, and you write about some of the people that have sold these diets. It's been a similar profile of person. Large doctors, for example.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, well, they're usually... I mean, so starting from... The guy in the 16th century, Luigi Cornaro, was a hugely fat and very wealthy merchant who realised that he was going to die. Doctors, of course, had very little... very few treatments and not very little idea. He devised his own diet, and really he was also a precursor of the calorie constrictors that we have now. So he did live a long time, actually. Up until his 90s, he lost an amazing amount of weight, and in the end he was existing on an egg yolk a day, and then, you know, if that was a bit too much, maybe half an egg yolk a day. So he was very extreme. But then there are, from the 19th century onwards, when the diet industry really takes off, and then there's the new media to back it up, there's the consolidation of the medical profession that really gets it going, and they specialise in, you know, digestive systems and dieting, and it's you get either an extremely fat person who devises their own diet and sells it, or you get an extremely fat doctor, say like Atkins, who devises their own diet and sells it, or you get a doctor who has an extremely fat patient that they devise a diet for and they sell it, like Dukan. And they're mainly men. They rely on science, or what they will sell you as science, and a bit of a celebrity packaging, as I've said. There are very few women. There are one or two, but mainly they're male doctors.
Because the diets are mostly aimed at women, though, aren't they? And you talk in your book about feminism beginning with the body, yeah, and the fact that dieting is persuading women to alter the shape of their body to lose control of that.
Yeah, it is mainly aimed at women, and there's a historical reason for that, in that of course, women didn't have the opportunities that we have now, or the education. So most of their social value is to do with what they look like and their marriageability. It's a question of survival. So they do want to conform to whatever the conventional beauty norm of their day is. And you'll find that even in medical texts, serious medical texts, you know, when they've been dissecting a woman who's worn corsets so that her liver has burst and her ribs are broken, they will put that down to vanity rather than, you know, the sort of demands that society makes upon them. So dieting has largely been aimed at women, and it's a double hit. You have to be like this, but, you know, why would you want to be like that? How vain of you. So it's a sort of double whammy that women get. Men have been the target of the diet industry, more so now, but really they have been since the 19th century, because they are another market, let's face it. But theirs is not to do with vanity. The male diet market is to do with masculinity and efficiency in the office and on the golf course. And it's discipline, a far more a positive thing that they're selling to men. But they're not, they don't escape.
And with regard to the corset, I was interested to read in your book that children were wearing corsets, men were wearing corsets as well.
Yes. I mean, from the 18th, women have worn them since, I suppose, early modern period, and children too. I mean, this is a sort of class issue too. So these would be mainly middle and upper class women and their children. There's a fantastically tiny corset in Kew Gardens, in the Royal Palace in Kew Gardens, that was worn by the 2-year-old prince. I can't remember his name, but the tiny little ones. It's to do with posture as well. But it's to do with appearance, which of course is, you know, what dieting is about largely. I mean, obviously to do with health as we think of it now, but you can't divorce health from appearance and aesthetic. The aesthetic sense has rather taken over, gone too far, I think. But men wore corsets, and in the 18th century they were wearing padding on their calves and on their thighs, and they wore little corsets to push their chests up, you know, to create a bust almost. And so body shaping is part of the story as well, and you'll find that the different shapes for men and women have changed throughout centuries as well.
And are we still obsessed in the same way? Is it better or worse, the way we feel about our you know, the way our body has to look?
Well, that's a tricky one. I think it's worse, because it affects more of the population and younger children. And there was a psychiatrist recently who'd said it amounted to a national neurosis. I think it's worse. I'm hoping that there'll be a backlash at some point. But, it's just everywhere, isn't it? And that's largely to do with the sort of flood of the media. It's just, I mean, you have to take one look at the internet, you know.
Absolutely.
Well, we are a corset-free zone today, I think I can
safely
say, yes. We're going to come back to you, Louise. We've got some big subjects to talk about, menopause and addiction. But we'll go for the moment to Sarah Maitland. Sarah Maitland is regarded as one of the vanguards of the 1970s feminist movement. Her first novel, Daughter of Jerusalem, won the Bristol Festival of Ideas Book Prize, and her non-fiction work, A Book of Silence, about celebrating and living with silence, was nominated for the same award in 2009. The same year, her short story, Moss Witch, was runner-up in the BBC National Short Story Award, and it's the title of her latest collection of short stories. I started by asking her if her fiction work and non-fiction work represent the two different sides of herself.
I don't think it does represent two different sides of myself, although you'd probably have to ask somebody else. I think it represents different subject matter and different stages in my life. I mean, my last book, The Gossip from the Forest, is both. It's both fiction and non-fiction in one book, so I don't think they really represent anything very different except different forms. I say the same way, you know, there's quite a lot of people who are extremely good novelists who are also short story writers, or extremely good novelists and also extremely good mothers. I think it's perfectly possible to have more than one skill at a time. We hope.
And you've said that the short story is your favourite short story.
It's my favourite to write, yes.
Why is that?
Well, it's short! No, I mean that quite seriously, actually. I get a kind of intensity of experience from something that you can write. Well, you can probably get a decent draft in a day, but you can get a finished work in a week.
And you use a lot of myths and folk stories, fairy tales in your writing. What is it about those that inspire you?
The cheap answer to that is laziness. That it seems to me that is a very good chance that a story, just a basic framework of story that has survived in a great many cultures for several centuries, is likely to be better than the story I think of all by myself today. I think there's, I mean, there is a more sort of serious thing to it than that. It kind of universalises what you're writing. It's a very economic form because you don't have to explain a lot about who people are, because who they are is usually not very important. You know, she was a princess, a king had a daughter, there was a third son of a miller. You don't have to do a lot about that kind of fussy placement revelation. So you've got more space, I believe, for emotional depth.
How would you describe your writing? Magic realism is how it has been described.
I would describe it as magic realism too. I'd describe it as magic realism, but to be absolutely honest, a lot of magic realists wouldn't. Angela Carter always said, when I was first writing, my writing was compared a lot with hers. And I said to her one day, I was fed up of being sub Angela Carter, and she said, don't worry about it, people will work it out. I'm a 60s libertarian and you're a 70s moralist. And I think that's right.
And in your latest book, Mosswitch, it's a very interesting structure because you have a short story followed by a piece by a scientist which explains the short story. Why did you decide to do that?
Again, there's always lots of reasons why you decide to do things, like somebody being prepared to commission it and those things. But in this case, about 3 or 4 years ago, I wrote a story called Mosswitch, which came out of a process, really. You talk to the scientist about what it is that they do, and you then make a story that explains, expands, mythologizes, metaphorates, or whatever the verb for that would be, on that science. And I just thought it was great fun to do. It was a very, very happy story for me because it was the runner-up in the BBC short story competition, and I was just really happy about that. But it's a wonderful process, and it was a wonderful thing to write, actually, because, well, within the stories themselves, they are completely mine. I had very little interference from the scientists, only help and sometimes correction. So it was immensely free at one level, but it also was not at all isolated or cut off. I mean, they were just wonderful on the whole. They always say you should write about what you know, but actually, maybe it's getting older or something, there's a great deal to be said for, in a different way, for writing about what you don't know. Because learning new stuff is extremely creatively energising. So every single story, you are actually learning new stuff. It's a very exciting way to write, actually.
You've spent the last 12 years of your life living in a remote part of Scotland.
Yeah.
But you've said there that you're pursuing a deep and joyful fascination with silence. What does that mean?
Well, first of all, just geographically, I live on a high moor. So there's, what, 8 houses up a 13-mile stretch of road. I mean, it really is very kind of empty countryside, and I chose it because of that. So that's one of the things it means. It just means you live where you don't see people very often. And I spend as much time as I can of that in silence, really. I mean, I hesitate to say that I'm a hermit because, as a matter of fact, I have no money other than the money that I earn. And I'm not really into subsistence living, and I'm certainly not in subsistence living on a high moor in the wettest part of Britain, so I do actually have to do some work.
And how does it work with your writing? Because I think you've said in the past that a silent life is not conducive to writing fiction.
And that might be one of the reasons why I moved towards writing more non-fiction. I mean, the last 2 big books have both been extended cultural histories of a sort. The one about forests and fairy stories and the one about silence itself. I can't imagine writing another novel. I kind of like to, but I haven't written a novel for almost exactly the same length of time as I've been. I had an obsession with silence, and I think they must be related.
And how does it feel coming out of that silence? You're at ARU now, about to speak to some creative writing students. How does that feel?
Well, actually, it's been very nice. I'm staying with a very dear friend, and it's nice to see your very dear friend, who you don't see very often if you're living on a back moor in southwest Scotland. So it's not that I never see anybody. You know, I'd like to move towards that. But, you know, I did quite a lot of promoting for the science story book. You've got to live. And also, I mean, that sounds slightly... That is not meant to sound cynical. It's meant to sound realistic. I teach an online course for Lancaster University, an online creative writing MA, which is great.
So you are in touch with the outside world, you have the internet.
Yes, I have the internet. I have a telephone, actually. I don't have a mobile, because we don't have any mobile signal. I don't have a television. I don't have any sound on my computer.
And you've described yourself as a socialist, a feminist, a Christian. It's been written that you spend 3 hours a day in prayer.
That's right, about.
How do those beliefs influence your writing, or your subject choice and your subject matter?
I think I'd sort of put it a slightly different way. I think that if you're the sort of writer that I am, and the sort of writer I think that most writers are, you don't kind of get together some jigsaw puzzle of personality and then think, aha, I know what I could do with this. I could write this book or on this subject or this theme. I don't think it quite works like that. I mean, you could put it the other way around, but nobody ever does. And says, well, if you're a writer, why are you also a socialist? How has your being a writer affected your socialism or your feminism or your Christianity or whatever you're doing? So I see it much more in a much more integrated kind of way, that people tend to write out of the person that they are. I mean, we talk a lot about authenticity and owned imagination and daring to tell the truth and stuff. So in one sense, being a writer is just a way of exploring the things that interest you, whatever the things that interest you are. I'm just kind of lucky because for much of my life, except for the religion bit, I happen to have been interested in things that are rather trendy. So, you know, I was a feminist in the 70s. I'm still a feminist, but I was writing much more explicitly feminist stuff because there was a really explicit interest in it. It's not like being a historian. You don't look back at a whole lot of subjects and think, what shall I write my next history on? I think being a creative writer is more integrated in a way. I mean, what I was saying earlier is I think that silence probably, or in my experience, as there really is the case that silence is not very good for the construction of linear plots. So you could say that adopting silence had caused me to write more short stories or more non-fiction. I don't know which comes first.
You mentioned you were right at the vanguard of 1970s feminism. Where do you see feminism now?
I think this is a complicated thing. I still think of myself absolutely as a feminist and also as a women's liberationist, which shouldn't be separate, but which have got separated. I find it very sad that American feminism apparently increasingly backs off global justice issues. I mean, I'm a feminist because there is not equal pay. I'm a feminist because who starves first is women. You know, in famine situations, women do worst. And even here in Britain, the wage disparity continues at all levels, all the way through, to be there. And I think that a feminism that doesn't link very closely what's happening there to sexual violence and to violence against women. I still see feminism as being a large and political issue rather than simply a personal self-development issue. I keep saying it's all, you've got to keep it all tied together. I've said that about the writing as well. But I think I do think that. There's a lot of stuff that I find quite weird that people call feminism, actually, that I just don't get it. And there's an issue which concerns me a lot, and I don't really know what to do about it and don't know who's thinking about it, and I'm probably not positioned to think about it, which is why the gay liberation movement did so much better than women did. I mean, they have been the real winners from this, better than both race and gender. And I find that quite strange and quite interesting. I mean, I don't want them to go on being miserable by any manner of means, but I do think there's something we're missing.
So I wanted to ask you about women writers today. More women writers than when you started writing.
No, women writers are more successful. I think there's always been more women writers than men writers. I think you can see that, you know, if you go back over the time. But I think there's two things. I mean, one is women writers have got a lot better both at writing and at some kind of self-assertion in the market. I think there's some unbelievably good young women writing. I was really, really impressed by No Violet's Bulawayo's Booker Prize list. We need new voices. I haven't read Luminaries yet. Coverage, well, there's still not enough, you know. You're still more likely to get your new novel, first novel reviewed if you are a bloke, and you're more likely to get more inches of review if you are a bloke, and you are more likely to get larger advances if you are a bloke. That's just how it is, you know? So we haven't finished yet.
That was Sarah Maitland there. We haven't finished yet. Louise, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with it. But I also think that feminism is for men and women because it equals out the roles. And I think it just does as much for men as it does for women. So I wouldn't want to draw a line between the sexes or between orientations. I think it's a good thing all round.
And the subjects that you've written about, addiction, menopause, dieting, obviously the central one there particularly applies to women. Has that been guiding you in what you've chosen to write about?
It doesn't necessarily guide me in what I choose to write about, but it does guide the way I write about the choices that I make. Yeah, I can't not. I think the personal is political and I can't keep it out.
And you've described yourself as a medical historian and said that you were first interested in that when you were secretly reading your mother's medical dictionary.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes. As a child, there was a fire on Liverpool Street Station and my dad, who was commuting then, brought this medical dictionary into the house and it was all charred and it stank and it was full of the most unpleasant drawings. And it was fascinating. It was absolutely fascinating to me and horrifying. And it sort of joined the dots, you know, that I was trying to fill in my childlike way of information about the human body. And it's just remained a fascination ever since.
And earlier you were saying that the book that you most, your favourite book, is the one about the menopause, and that was the one that made you angriest.
Yeah.
Why was that?
I started writing it. It was when I was 40. I'm 58 now. No, I'm not. I'm 57. When I started writing it, I was 42, and I had some sort of indeterminate complaint. And the young doctor that I went to couldn't find what it was and said, oh, well, what age are you? You must be perimenopausal. And I was appalled. I was too young. What did he mean? What did he know anyway? And, you know, that's the end of the world, isn't it? And when I came away, I was more appalled by my reaction to the idea of menopause, because obviously I'm going to have one day, and more than 50% of the global population will have one. What's the big problem? So I thought, well, I'll go and look into that. And of course, the whole history is to... I used mostly medical texts and essays and diagnoses, cases, you know, medical cases, plus diaries and letters and whatnot. But it's a damning history of decay and the end of life. Mainly the medical profession was only interested in women to the point at which they were no longer fertile. And then, as they called it, that's the gateway to death. You're finished, basically. And that idea, which comes from Greek and Roman medicine and informs modern Western medicine, is utterly detrimental to older women and their idea of themselves and their place in society. It's huge and it has massive repercussions. And you'll hear menopause bandied about as an insult to women. And I actually wanted younger women to read the book, but I can see why they might not want to. But I think they should, because I've written it to remove that dread and that fear. Because obviously, you know, menopause can be difficult for some women, but most of the medical texts are based on women that have presented themselves for treatment, and they are the ones that are having a hard time. But there are many, many women who just have it and sail through it and think, oh well, you know, maybe I can't sleep so much tonight and so. But I mean, that it's all right and that you can happily do it and have a viable life afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it is completely shocking to see how our attitudes and beliefs are based on really rubbish or things that were very, you know, very ignorant beliefs. Yeah. But even quite recently, I mean, fair enough, there was sort of brutality and misbeliefs hundreds of years ago, but even in the 60s there were things. Tell us about some of that.
Well, I assume you're talking about Feminine Forever. There's a very famous book, a best-selling book about menopause, written by what was his name, Wilson. I must read the book again sometime. but it was a best-selling book, and it more or less talks about menopause as an absolute tragedy, and you know, the end of life as we know it, that women past menopause are castrates, and they actually would be better off dead. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible book. But this was written in the 1960s at a point when hormone treatment was really big news and was being sold. And in actual fact, of course, later on it's discovered that the chap was being paid by one of the major pharmaceutical companies, and his wife, who was on HRT for donkey's years, eventually sickened and died, and there was a huge scandal when she died of breast cancer a bit later on. There's no cure for menopause, because menopause is not a disease. I think if you're having a tough time and it does affect your quality of life, then you might want to do something about it. But on the whole, just, you know, leave well alone. It goes away and it gets better afterwards.
You still sound quite angry about it.
I am angry. Well, I'm angry because of the way that menopause is treated, but also because of the way society sees older women. And there are more and more older women talking about it, talking about that there's the assumptions that are made about us now. And the voices are growing. And largely, I think that's also to do with those 1970s feminists getting older and growing up and having something to say about that. But that's my favourite book, because it really changed my view of myself and my future, and I would like it to do that for other women. And angry because of the way we have been treated, and some of the treatments, some of the early surgeries, some of the you know, the madnesses, the insanity that have been associated with it, and the treatments that go with that, the drug treatments, the experimental. I mean, if men had menopause, I'm referring to the Susan Sontag essay of If Men Menstruated, which is a fantastic piece of work, you know. Effectively, if men menstruated, there would be national institutions, there would be, you know, days off each month for them to recuperate, to be in touch with themselves. You know, it's a wonderful. And if men had menopause, there would be a lot more known about it. Not much is known about menopause.
Oh, fascinating. And we're going to move on to addiction soon. We're really covering all the bases today.
We
did
a lot of programme, don't we?
We do. Second piece of music now is Big Brother and the Holding Company featuring Janis Joplin, Piece of My Heart. Why did you choose this?
Oh, I love her. I love her. And if I was a singer, I'd sing like her. Unfortunately, I do it in private, but obviously nobody wants to hear me try this in public. She's fantastic. And so full of life and passion and energy. It's just sort of, it's just marvellous listening to her. And then the downside is that she died at 27 of a drug overdose.
Hello and welcome back to Bookmark with Alex Rouget and Lee Chambers. Today in the studio we have Louise Foxcroft, and Louise, you're going to do a reading for us now from Calories and Corsets.
Yes. I've chosen this. It was quite difficult to choose a piece, actually, but I've chosen this because it's a little story about a diet guru. His name was Benjamin Gaylord Houser. So he's a Hollywood diet guru, of which we have many, and they keep coming. And he was working in the 1920s and 1930s. So, the medical profession reserved particular contempt for this wealthy health food dietitian to the stars. Houser was all over the press, written about almost as much as the starlets he advised, and was referred to as a nationally known, famous Viennese expert on food science. He was actually a charismatic, handsome, youngish man with a flashy smile and a broken accent who wears his hair in a permanent wave. His doctorate was not as permanent as his hair, however, and had to be dropped after an investigation by the American Medical Association. He wasn't even Viennese, let alone any sort of expert, but he had plenty of elaborate diets, including the eliminative feeding system, the mending diet, the vitality diet, the transition diet, the cosmetic diet, an iron-rich cocktail of spinach, parsley and citrus juice for a beautiful skin, the zigzag diet, which advised a morning purge of Epsom salts and an evening dose of senna. In this last diet, most of the weight loss was due to a commonly available salt and cathartics, which Houser was selling under his own and expensive brand name. nothing new there then. His whole system of diets was, according to the medics, based on misconceptions and fallacies, and it was dangerous to the public to follow these notions. Hauser was, they complained, a con man selling diets to gullible people. Hauser's books are written in a tone of a self-styled prophet come to bestow upon his adoring female disciples the truth and way of their proper and only calling to be beautiful. His book, Eat and Grow Beautiful, 1939, was written at a point in history when you might imagine the world had more on its mind than this, describing what he proclaimed to be a new and simple design for living. He claimed his regimen had been followed religiously by, quote, the smart women, the leaders in fashion and society. And they discovered an answer to everything in Hauser's cosmetic diet and were proclaiming it to be the cornerstone on which they'd built new beauty, new vitality, new happiness. These women, he wrote with undisguised self-congratulation and a beady eye on the market, had made of his teachings a vogue which others clamour to follow. And who would want to be left out? And who would dare? After all, according to Hauser, beauty, for those women who were lucky enough to possess it, was a thing to be cherished. But to those less fortunate beings who aspire to it, it is a goal towards which they continuously strive. And this is the same old line that women have always been sold. They could be better, younger, more loved, if only they bought whatever lotion, potion or system was on offer. Hauser had set himself up in Hollywood because he understood the power of the movie industry and knew that so many diets originated there because, he said, most of our high-priced movie stars are living in constant fear of losing their attractiveness and thereby their popularity. They simply can't afford to become fat and unattractive. They know only too well how their public will forget them if they do. No beauty aid was too expensive, no regimen too drastic for these lovely ladies of the screen, and so too, of course, for the masses of ordinary women in the street who wanted desperately to be like them. This is early celebrity culture. One of Hauser's lovers, the immaculate Greta Garbo, had him to thank for manufacturing her slim androgynous elegance. She slavishly followed his directions, sliding narrowly about on the big screen as a long-running silent advertisement for the benefits of salads and juices. The result was that women everywhere took to serious dieting and vigorous exercise regimes. And this, there was actually a great worry about the slimming mania in America at this time. So women were beginning to look like boys, and they were worried about, you know, the downfall of society, the ruination of the home, and lesbianism. An obvious result of dieting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Public demand for films seemed insatiable. By the 1920s, the Hollywood movie industry was already worth over $2 billion, and the parallel demand for physically perfect actors was, and still is, an impossibly challenging requirement. Indeed, the movie world so influenced perceptions of both body shape and character that in 1924, a Dr. McLester had been moved to write in the Journal of the American Medical Association that a fat face has a monstrous uniformity. No theatrical producer would hire a plump actress to mirror the real depths of the human soul. And that's a doctor.
Wow. Goodness me. It really has been the domain of the charlatan.
Yes, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, there are plenty of quacks and charlatans that have been producing diet. I mean, there are plenty of medics, like some of those mentioned there, who rail against the charlatan and do want people to diet for health reasons and have some very sensible ways of doing it, but they don't have the publicity and the PR. And like I said before, it's a long, slow, sensible process, and it doesn't have that novelty and, you know, shiny, quick fix stuff. You spend pounds, you don't lose your pounds, you know, it goes on and on. And there's been some fantastically ridiculous ways of dieting. I mean, you've mentioned some of them, but I mean, the diet drugs, for example, which in the 19th century could contain anything from lard, you know, which seems really weird, to arsenic, and then one called dinitrophenol in the early 20th century, was actually a fertilizer and a carcinogenic dyeing agent, and it was used in World War I explosives, and it raised the metabolism, it sent people blind, it ruined their livers, and there were some fatalities, and it wasn't banned in America until 1938. Hundreds of thousands of people took it, and there have been recent reports in the press. It's now called DNP, and it's there's a big scandal going on because it's being bought online.
On this,
it's immensely
the
dangerous.
The recent one, is it Ali, the one that was marketed as Ali?
I called it that, but I think it's actually called Ally. But that's another one. That one stops you absorbing fat. It's unbelievably expensive, and you're going to lose a very small amount of weight. I think average weight loss is 2.5 kilograms. But by stopping you absorbing fat, it just comes...
Straight out again.
And it's a deeply unpleasant thing. And really, if you just take, you know, some sensible measures over a long period of time, you're going to be a lot better off. It's just small lifestyle changes. There's been a huge recent scandal in France over a drug called Mediator, and that was banned in 2009 after at least 500 deaths.
Wow. Well, we're going to come on to talk about a different kind of drug after our next interview, which is with the short story writer Helen Simpson. Helen is actually a very rare thing. She's a very successful award-winning British short story writer who has only written short stories in her career, which has lasted so far 30 years. And she has 5 collections of short stories, which were most recently brought together in a selected collection. We met in London a few weeks ago at King's Place. We thought we were being very clever and we snuck outside by the water. We had fur rugs and we felt like we were in a Chekhov story. But we were then plagued by noisy smokers, howling wind and cawing crows. So perhaps we were in a Chekhov story, I don't know. But anyway, you have to forgive the background noise. But we had a wonderful chat and I started off by asking her how she felt looking back over her 5 collections.
I was pleased when I read them through. I just was. That sounds conceited, but I thought, yes, they're good. Right, keep at it. Very mad at myself for being so slow.
You do talk about them, how it takes you a long time. Do you find, in the process of those 5 years when you're writing, you know, are you losing motivation and focus about the actual collection, or have you now developed a way of just saying that's fine, I'm doing this, I'm working towards the goal? And
well, up until now I haven't thought about a collection in advance.
I'm just
writing a story at a time and hoping that there'll be some unity theme, okay. Because I'm only writing about what's really interesting me at the time.
To you at the time, yeah.
So whatever's currently fascinating gives some cohesion. But there is overlap between collections. I think Dear George and Hey, I Write, Get a Life, you notice there some sort of, you know, the same subject matter.
Mm-hmm. So you don't decide on a theme beforehand, you just set off writing.
And quite, I must say, with collections of short stories, I do like some that are themed, but sometimes they can just feel cooked up. You know, there'll be 3 or 4 that are outstanding and then some that are make weights because you feel that they're, I've got to do more on this theme. I'd rather they just do it on another theme if it's like that, but something that really fascinates them, you know.
And you talk about putting collection together and how one story can throw a light on another story. Is that something you enjoy then?
Yes, I think that once you've got 7 or 8 stories, or 6 or 7,
okay,
then you're thinking, right, this is going to be a collection.
Okay.
And you look at them, you put them out on the floor in front of you, and sort of look at their shapes. Don't arrange them in a line, just maybe in a sort of semicircle or something, and then think, well, right, that one there, I think we want something equally extreme, but at the other end of the spectrum, and then will I be able to do that? Yes, actually I can see a way into that, and then you have that fun of finding an imaginative way into the, you know, to see whether it'll work imaginatively if you can do it.
Okay.
Then, yes.
So the collection itself inspires you to write 1 or 2 more stories, would you say? To fill
the
gaps.
Towards the end. Not to fill the gaps, okay. It's more a calibration business.
Yeah. You also say in that introduction something about more than a very little character exploration in a short story, and you're edging towards the grotesque. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, B.S. Pritchett, he did use the story form quite a lot for... he had a patch of time when he was doing character studies, and they are like very worked up... I mean, they're fascinating. It's one about a sailor. You can see him and hear him and so on. It's very, very vivid, but it's Dickensian to me. And I'm not sure it's the place to explore character, the story. I think the novel is for that, or theatre perhaps. Theatre's more like the short story, though, in terms of you're presenting. You're not, and there are suggestions coming off, but you're not doing the exploring work that a novelist does for you. You're not sort of commenting what's going on inside their thoughts and talking about where they went to school and, you know, and what happened in their childhood. It's much more foreshortened, eyelid.
So you're exploring situation, would you say?
Yes, yes. I think. And obviously, characters. There are characters, recognisable characters, but they're. In some stories, I quite like the ones where there aren't names or not surnames as well, not all the details, because that seems novelistic. When there are all the surnames and what car they drive and all the things, all those details, it seems to me more like a novel. It's more padding. Lots of stories where you just know one name, but the name there, or sometimes not even know their name. It's more like a ballad or a song. You've got the situation, you've got the strong feeling. And you can get just as much complexity, but without all that padding, yeah.
So how much do you yourself know about your characters before you start writing?
I used to sort of every now and then read that sort of advice that says you must make a file on them, you must know them really well, back to front and inside out. I just didn't find it useful. Mm-hmm. I started getting bored, you know. I didn't want to know all that. It's like with Catherine Mansfield met Hardy once, and he apparently said to her about her story, Daughters of the Late Colonel. Do you know that one where these two elderly women and their aged father has just died and they're terrified and talking about the situation? And he said, well, why don't you work that up into a novel? Why don't you make that longer? You've got those two characters. And she said, what on earth? Why would I want to do that? That's you know, it's as it is. It's just finished. Yeah, it's complete.
I'm going to use the D word here and talk about the domestic. I think you're both applauded and criticised maybe in the past for writing domestic. Would you say that prejudice against that kind of kitchen sink drama still exists?
Well, it does here for some reason in the UK. I think yes, it's used as a denigratory adjective. Mm-hmm. You think Alice Munro, you think John Updike. Well, I don't mind, you know, they're domestic,
no,
absolutely. That's fine. I mean, when they criticise it, doesn't mean they want the action all to take place outside. Mm-hmm. Has it got to be all cowboys or, you know, in good weather somewhere? Mm. Does it have to involve, there's nothing clever about getting on a plane, but people talk and act as though there is.
It's never held you personally back, though, has it? It's been, in a way, it's been a good thing for you. You've written those stories, and certainly your readers love to read those stories, don't they?
Well, it's nice of you to say so. I don't know. Yeah. But I do from readings. When I started out, there was a women's magazines. I think they maybe their audience read a lot, great deal. I know my mother used to get Woman's Journal and Good Housekeeping. They both did very good stories every month by people like William Trevor, Edna O'Brien. As well as by Tyrose, and Cosmopolitan during the 80s, I think they had a dedicated fiction editor, Kate Figes, and she ran a London book day. That was before the festivals really started up. But and then again, they were very good stories. Much less so now the magazines. I don't quite. Perhaps it's because they are more for shopping now. You know,
consumer-led, I suppose, yeah.
And also, a lot of feature writing and stories have gone to the newspapers. You know, there didn't used to be those T2 and G2, which... So that's partly what hoovered up the good writing.
Yeah. So do you think it's harder now to be a short story writer?
The newspapers still... They seem to want Christmas stories quite a lot.
Themed, yeah.
Or summer stories. The newspapers are doing more than they used to. And newspaper magazines, when you think of the Guardian Weekends, you know, every year they seem to do a summer one with lots of stories, which is really good news.
And the Times with the prize, that big prize.
There
that
are
they
lots
do.
More prizes there than are. There ever were. Massive prizes. But,
do you think
which is great, but if you write stories, you want people to read them. And with prizes, you know, are people likely to buy a volume of stories for a certain prize? Well, they might, but especially if they've got a friend who's got a story in it. But it's not a... You actually... No, you want to be out there. You want to feel, no, people are buying these because they want to read them.
Yeah.
You know?
And does a prize change the kind of story that people, a person has to write? Because it needs to stand out from a batch of 10,000 other stories. You know,
well,
quiet
there,
stories.
I think it's really hard. I know that you were saying before we started the interview that you're, you know, this business of going in for competitions and wondering about subject matter and so on. Well, I judge a lot of them, or have done in the last... I must try and stop judging too many of them. They take a
and
while.
And write more.
But you see, but the sifting process, very often by the time it gets to the judges, they'll have been sifted. And so you'll be down to the last 20 or 30 or sometimes even a dozen. Mm-hmm. And there might have been 1,000 coming in. So I'd say to anybody, don't feel judged, because it really isn't just false cheering up. The sifters might have a completely different taste to... Generally, something very good will get through, but it's subjective. Mm. It's subjective. Mm. You've seen it, you know, time and again when there's these things like the Booker. Mm-hmm. You get different judges. People who are interested, they'll look at the long list, they'll maybe read it, and then they'll be amazed at what actually is elected. You know, you think, oh, and then you realise this is subjective.
It's very subjective, absolutely. And what are you working on at the moment? You've got a new
collection. More stories.
That was Helen Simpson there. Apologies again for the sound quality. And we've only got a few minutes left now, but Louise, I'm just going to ask you briefly, your first book was The Making of Addiction. Why did you choose to write about that?
I'd been researching history of medicine, and with particular regard to opium, which was pretty much the only drug available that was any use in painkilling until aspirin in the 1890s. But of course, there were all these stories of addiction and it was difficult to reconcile a sort of wonder drug with a demon drug, if you like. And I was quite interested in that changeover and why we regard opium use, chronic opium use, as a bad thing. And, of course, all the derivatives, you know, morphine, heroin, and why we have such difficult trouble with people that use drugs luxuriously, as is the old way, or orthodox, and just the stigma that attaches to drug addiction. I thought, well, I need to go in and have a look at that and see where that stigma comes from.
And also, you've got two other books that we haven't yet touched on. Do you want to tell us just quickly about your historical biography of Geir Andersen?
Yeah, I've been working on that for well over a decade now. He's an Edwardian Egyptologist of the Geir Andersen cat, which is in the British Museum now, and he was there when they opened Tutankhamun's tomb in 1923. A fantastically rip-roaring, adventurous life in Cairo and the Sudan, fought at Gallipoli. I mean, it's an astonishing life. I've got access to his unpublished memoirs, and that's now with Unbound Books, which is a fantastic venture, a crowdsourcing publisher. So if you go to unbound.co.uk, you can see my book, you can see a video of me talking about it, and hopefully pledge on it, because that's how crowdsourcing works. And the other book is a book on sexuality in a series called All That Matters for Hodder and Stoughton, and that's out towards the end of this year.
Well, I'm sorry we haven't had more time to talk about that. We'll have to get you back for another interview, I think. Good. Thank you ever so much, Louise. Our next show?
Our next show, our studio guest is Rowan Pelling. She's editor of the Eroshik Review. I did an interview with Sarah Dinant about her new novel about the Borgias, and you spoke to Jasper Gibson.
I did, yes, about his book, A Bright Moon for Fools.
So do join us for that. All our podcasts of the old shows are on the website. Louise, we're going to finish with your last choice now, which is Dinah Washington, Long John Blues.
Yeah, I love this, and everybody will, and it's to do with the sexuality book and how we can't talk openly about sexuality and ignore it. It's a sort of euphemistic mid-20th century song about sex.